some family were gathering together, extended family. Some had come over from Adelaide, and we decided to do something. The boys decided to do something together, and so we booked tickets to go and see a one-day part of the fifth Ashes test between Australia and England at the SCG. And my only experience of a cricket match turned out to be an incredibly memorable day. The newspapers the following day said it was the best day's cricket in a long time. Why was that? Well, for one thing, the War brothers, Steve and Mark, scored a century each and scored 198 in their partnership. Darren Goff, the English bowler, scored a hat-trick. And so it went on. The day was just full of excitement. But the day was even more memorable for one other reason, and that was what was happening off the field. For over to my left were the chanting, raving Barmy Army. And it was a real entertainment in itself. There were a couple of police arrests. There was one fellow who had climbed up one of the light poles with an English flag and was swinging around like this, you know, waving the flag. We all thought the whole thing was going to topple. But it was great entertainment. There was a beach ball that was being bounced around the crowd. There were wolf calls any time a pretty girl went past. There were scuffles. There was crowd surfing. There was communal singing. There was a trumpet player down the front, you know, trumpeting English anthems. And on it went. And all that alone, I thought, was worth the entry fee. I thought, if this is cricket, I'm coming back. It didn't really matter what was happening down on the field. We forgot about the match. I didn't actually see the hat trick. I really missed what was going on. Now, it's possible to have an experience of something, but to miss the real action. And so it is with Christmas. And people who go, like you and I, who come to church, are not immune from this. We can miss the real action. In the Christmas story, there are people who experienced the first Christmas, the birth of Jesus, the miracle of the incarnation, but they missed what was really going on for various reasons. And I want this morning just to consider a few of them, not just for pure historical interest, but they appear in the gospel stories as typical, as caricature of responses. And they are typical of responses that people make today to the Christmas story, and people today still miss the real action for the same reasons that these people did back then. In a way, the gospel writers are saying to the reader, we want you to be invited and challenged to consider yourselves in these stories. To ask yourself, am I really like that? Now remember, these people were all people who had the experience of Christmas, just like us, but they were people who really missed the real action. The first is the innkeeper. You know his story. We don't know much. In fact, we hardly know anything about the innkeeper. Luke tells us when they, Joseph and Mary, were there, the time came for the baby to be born, and she gave birth to her firstborn, a son. She wrapped him in clothes and placed him in a manger because there was no room for him in the inn. Now, we don't know what the inn was. It could have been a shanty, it could have been a lean-to or a shed or an outhouse or something like that. It doesn't really matter. They didn't go in there. They went outside. They had five-star accommodation. There was a big no-vacancy sign out the front door. We're just told that he had no room for them. Now, whatever, just imagine this. That poor old innkeeper didn't realise that he had missed the birth of God, of the incarnation, veiled in flesh, the Godhead see, as the hymn writer writes. But he didn't see it. He missed the Trinitarian hat trick. Now, why did he miss it? Because he was preoccupied. It was census time in Bethlehem, and the town was bulging with people, every family whose ancestry could be traced back there. And the innkeeper was just too busy. He wasn't hostile. He wasn't unsympathetic. He wasn't indifferent to the plight of this family. He was just busy. And he's a caricature of millions. We're so consumed with activity, aren't we, of the season. The shopping, the parties, the special services, the performances, the decoration of the Christmas tree, if you can find it, like I couldn't after last Christmas. I couldn't find where I'd put it away, so we had to go and find another one. I think I tossed it out. But that was half a day's exercise in itself. The holiday plans, the Christmas pudding, the turkey, the seating plans for Christmas Day lunch, the Boxing Day stampede down at the local shops. 1,001 things that can keep us busy. And in the clutter of activity, we are so busy and distracted at celebrating the birth of the Son of God, we actually miss it. Now, what the story of the innkeeper can say to us is that it is possible, to actually turn away the Son of God unwittingly. We may not reject him out of hostility or antagonism or indifference, but by just having other things on our mind. Now, remember, when Jesus grew up, he told a parable about being too busy for God's kingdom. A certain king, he said, was throwing a wedding for his son, and all sorts of invitations went out to the special notorieties. And the RSVPs began to return. Can't come. I'm too busy. I've got a new wife. I've got a new business. I've got a new acquisition. And the point of that parable, Jesus says, if we don't make time for God, he won't have time for us. Very poignant point. So like the innkeeper, we can miss Christmas just through busyness. Secondly, the person of Herod. Herod's a very disturbing man, and he was a very disturbed man. And he missed Christmas because of fear. We're told in Matthew's gospel that he was troubled when he heard the news about the baby to be born and that people were going to worship him. Now, Herod was a very powerful man. Herod's father, Antipater, had done some favours for Rome. And as a reward, the Herod family had the right to rule Judea. Herod did everything he could to please Rome, and in return, the Roman Senate gave him an army, and Herod was able to extend his empire from Judea to Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon. He called himself the King of the Jews, and he was known by that title until his death. It's no wonder that he was agitated when he heard the news of a newborn baby was being hailed as the King of the Jews, a rival. But not only was Herod powerful, he was ruthless. Herod had murdered all the Hasmoneans. The Hasmoneans were the sons of the Maccabeans who had led a revolution. And he wanted to make sure they didn't do it again, so he slaughtered them all. One of Herod's 12 wives had a brother named Aristobulus, who was the high priest. And Herod was afraid of him, so he killed Aristobulus along with his wife. Sometime during his reign, he was afraid that one of his own sons may seize the throne, so he murdered both of his sons, or two of them. And 5 days before his death, he executed his eldest son for plotting against the throne. In one of his final acts before he died, Herod ordered that the most distinguished citizens of Jerusalem be put to death the moment he died. He was quoted as having said, "The people will not weep when I die, and I want them weeping, even if they weep over someone else." So even at his death, there was a great slaughter. You can see that the character of this man and the story about the slaughter of the firstborn children is not too hard to believe. It's not difficult to imagine his volatile reaction when he learned that the Magi were not going to report back to him the whereabouts of this newborn child. And so Matthew tells us when Herod realized that he had been outwitted by the Magi, he was furious. He gave orders to kill all the boys in Bethlehem and its vicinity who were 2 years old and under. In his mad effort to wipe out one child, Herod killed dozens of innocent children. And Herod missed the first Christmas and catapulted the country into a great tragedy because of his threat, his fear. Now, I know you're sitting there and I'm standing here and I'm saying, I'm nothing like Herod. You know, I don't have the sweep of Herod's power. But at its core, the fear of losing power or control is something that affects all of us. I think it's the same sort of fear that elderly people go through, as my mother did, when they go into nursing care. When they have to go through the trauma of no longer being able to feed themselves, to look after themselves. What's behind that? It's a fear. It's a fear of the loss of freedom, the loss of independence, the loss of control. It's a similar sort of thing. We love to be in control. We love to control others. Maybe in a microcosm sort of a way compared to Herod, but we still do it. But the Christmas claim of Christ is that he is Lord. That baby in a manger became the resurrected Lord. And Luke tells us that the response of Herod was similar among the crowd. In Luke 19, the world is full of people who cry out, and I quote, "We do not want this man to reign over us." Isn't that the cry of the human heart today at Christmas? We love a baby in a manger, but we don't want this man to reign over us. We may know him, we may believe in him, but we don't want to surrender to him and shape our lives around his teaching because we fear what we may lose. But that is to miss Christmas. Thirdly, the inhabitants of Jerusalem. Jesus was born in Bethlehem, which was just outside of Jerusalem. And it seems from the gospel stories that no one in Jerusalem really cared two hoots about the birth of Jesus. It was completely overlooked. And instead, God picked a band of shepherds out in the fields to hear the news first. Now, why did the inhabitants of Jerusalem miss Christmas? I mean, this was the Messiah, the King, come to visit his people. Jerusalem seemed to be the obvious choice, apart from an Old Testament prophecy. But the answer is religion. In Jerusalem, the temple was there. Everyone who wanted to make a sacrifice had gone there. And again, people were consumed with a different type of activity this time, the feasts, the festivals, the washings, the religious externals. And it all culminated to the culture of Jerusalem at the time was really hollow, spiritually and morally. We know this because when Jesus grew to be an adult, and we know what he said about Jerusalem. For instance, when he went into the temple courts and overturned the tables of the money changers because the complete system had become corrupt. When he stood outside Jerusalem and he cursed the fig tree, an enacted parable, which then withered and died. It was a piece of dramatic theatre where Jesus was trying to depict Jerusalem's withered faith that had all but died. Jerusalem was worshipping the right God in the wrong way. They were caught up in the externals of religion, and they had abandoned the heart of their faith. And so it is today. It's a caricature with those who want to be religious. If we want to just go through the motions, the routines, and the rituals without a regenerated heart and a lively face, we too will miss the Christmas story. Fourthly, the Romans miss Christmas. Caesar Augustus, who was Caesar at the time of Jesus' birth, was the grandnephew of Julius Caesar. And Caesar Augustus promoted emperor worship. Indeed, he took the title Pontifex Maximus, highest priest. And here, an entire empire missed the Christmas. Why? Because of idolatry. The Romans had their own gods, and they had even elevated their ruler, their emperor, to the status of a deity. The Christ who came did not fit the Roman pantheon, so they ignored him. He was a complete irrelevancy. And these people worship what the Bible calls idols. Now, let's think about that for a minute, lest we excuse ourselves too quickly for saying that we don't have an idol at home. An idol, what is an idol? An idol is this. An idol is whatever we believe has power to save us from what threatens to bring me undone. Shall I say that again? An idol is whatever we believe has power to save me from whatever threatens to bring me undone. Now, people look to different things. They may have little trinkets. They may have little lucky charms. They may have lotto tickets, because they think that those things will save them from catastrophe or, put positively, bring them into prosperity. So you see that an idol need not be a statue. It's whatever I look to save me, to advance me, something beyond my own powers. I will then submit to it. I will depend upon it. I will look to it. I will worship it. It could be another person whom we idolize to save us from loneliness. It could be this church or this tradition that we belong to. It could be family. It could be wealth. It could be a thousand things. The Romans had no need of Christ because they believed in some other power that could promote them or save them. And they missed Christmas. And we too, with our modern day idols, can miss Christmas for the same reasons. Fifth and last, the people of Nazareth. You know, Nazareth was where Jesus grew up. And we're told in Luke chapter 4 that when Jesus, as a man, returned to his hometown, they rejected him. He went to the synagogue, you might remember, and he stood up to read the scroll and read from Isaiah, "The Spirit of the Lord is on me because he has anointed me to preach good news to the poor." Well, no argument there. It's in the text. But it's what he said next that disturbed them. "Today this scripture is fulfilled in your hearing," referring to himself. And he went on to say, "I tell you the truth, no prophet is accepted in his hometown." All the people, and Luke goes on to say, "All the people in the synagogue were furious when they heard this. They got up, drove him out of the town, and took him to the brow of the hill on which the town was built in order to throw him off the cliff." These were the people who knew him best. They tried to kill him. Resonates with what John says in his gospel. He came to that which was his own, but his own did not receive him. What was their problem? Familiarity. They knew him too well. They knew him too well to believe that he was anyone special or unique. He's from Joseph's family. We know Joseph's family. We know him. He's just like us. We know where he's from. We've known him since he was knee-high to a locust, I guess. They thought they really knew him, but they didn't. What's the problem with them? We have a saying, don't we? Familiarity, go on, complete it for me, breeds contempt. Why do we say that? I sat down this week and tried to unearth why familiarity breeds contempt. The only thing I could come up with was something like this. Familiarity is dismissive. It dismisses any claim of someone to be special or unique or extraordinary by drawing attention to the ordinary, the plain, the mundane, and their weaknesses. Familiarity keeps a person in their box, and it tends to lose respect for who they really are if they are unique. It's a way of saying, I have a handle on that person. I really know them. You may be surprised by what they're doing, but I've got inside knowledge. I know them. It's a bit like the bear tamer who thinks he has a handle on the bear. But it's pretty dangerous familiarity if you don't respect that the fact that the bear is a wild animal and can turn on you at any time. Watch out if you lose respect and you get too familiar. This is probably what the people of Nazareth were doing. We've got a handle on this guy. We know who he is. You know, don't pay any attention to his special claims. He's just a boy from Joseph's family. See, it's the temptation to domesticate Jesus, to bring him down to our size, maybe even to humanise him too much. And we can do this these days. I've heard it where we say sometimes, Jesus is my saviour. But what we mean by that is that he's there to fix up my problems. Or popularly among the young people, just look at some of the songs, the Christian songs that we sing, Jesus is my boyfriend. It's a romantic type of relationship that they have with him. Or we can say that Jesus is my comfort. Now, of course, you know, he is our comfort, but he's not only our comfort. And by bringing him down like that, by being too familiar, particularly if we've been Christians for a long time, it may be to overlook the fact that he's the King of Heaven, this little baby in a manger. He can't be boxed in. He's the Lord of all, the King of Kings. I wondered if I should put this next sentence or question in. I think I will. And if you really don't like it, there'll be a public burning outside. I'll never reach my Christmas day. Here's the question. Could it be that in any church, St. Thomas's included today, that if Jesus walked through the door, like the people of Nazareth, we'd turf him out? Because he would blow our expectations of who we think he is to who he really is. Being too familiar might mean that we've missed Christmas. And we need to watch for that. So there were five responses to Jesus back then, and they're responses that are as alive today as they were back then. But like that first cricket match that I went to, it's possible to have the experience of Christmas and miss all the action because of these five responses. Religion. Having a form of godliness without its power, says Paul in Timothy's letters. Familiarity. I want a Jesus that's just like me. Idolatry. Jesus is really an irrelevancy. I need him for some things, but I look to other things to save me and to promote me. Busyness. I just don't have any time for him except at Christmas and Easter. Or fear. We do not want this man to reign over us. Well, I commend those responses to you in terms of reflecting on your own soul, which I think we might do now. Rather than me ending this sermon with a prayer, let's have a moment's silence, and you can bring your own heart and mind before the Lord.